Hell yeah, man, I'm all for that. So we asked NASCAR if they would, you know, let us do that and get them in the car with me, and they were gracious enough to allow us to do that, and we had fun. That was one of the coolest moments. People asked me what was so cool about the whole experience after the race, and that was probably number one.
For USA Radio News, I'm Tim Berg.
So hello, it's Joe Peters. I'm sitting here with Eric Kolb. Hey, Eric, say hello.
Hey, Joe, how are you? Great to be here.
So we're doing good. We're showing on the meter that we're registering properly. So here's what we're going to do. We're going to play a few commercials for you guys, and then we're going to start with the Weber, and then we're going to go pick up Eric's partner, and we're going to have a long conversation about his trip to the Normandy coast. And I did it 2 years ago, so I think we can relate very nicely. So stay tuned, and in about 6 minutes, we're going to be back, and we'll get into that conversation.
This is Georgine Trinkle. I want to invite you to listen to Huntin' Hunterd In every Monday from 4 to 5 p.m. You'll be treated to discussions on hot topics every week. Huntin' Hunterd In provides a more in-depth look at issues that are happening right now. You can catch the show live and call in on what matters to you. Make sure to download the podcast to catch up on all our hot topics.
So once again, it's Joe Peters, and I've asked me to give you the weather. Before we get started, let me give you the date. It is November 19th. It happens to be my birthday. You don't have to send cards in. But November 19th, 2019, we're sitting in scenic downtown Flemington. It's 4:05 p.m. It is 46 degrees as we sit. It looks like overnight we're going to go down into the 36 range and come back up tomorrow and be as high as 48, low as 34. Thursday, high as 54, low as 39. Friday, heat wave, 59 degrees, 28 overnight. And then Saturday, it's going to get a little rainstorm go through, and the front will change us to a 43-degree high. So we're clear through the end of Friday into Saturday. Enjoy your weather. We're going to play a few commercials, and we'll be right back.
Are you looking to get your message in front of a qualified audience through all the noise out there today? Consider taking an advertisement out on Hunterdon Chamber Radio, WHCR, DB, the voice of business. Contact the Chamber today at 908-782-7115 or give us an email at info@hunterdon-chamber.org. You're listening to WHCR-DB, Hunterdon Chamber Radio.com. Brought to you by the Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce, the voice of business.
Sabía que de cada cinco personas hay una que lucha con síntomas difíciles de salud mental. NAMI es una organización estatal sin fines de lucro. Somos empleados voluntarios. Somos la voz de la nación sobre las enfermedades mentales. NAMI te ofrece grupos de apoyo, educación e información. Nuestro programa educativo de Familia a Familia está dirigido por miembros de NAMI para familiares y amigos de personas que luchan con dificultad de salud mental. Llámanos al 888-803-3413. Recuerda, no estás solo. NAMI está contigo y no hay salud sin salud mental.
Did you know that 1 in 5 people are affected by mental illness? NAMI Hunterdon is the locally affiliate for NAMI, the National Alliance on Mental Illness. We are all volunteers and all our programs are free of charge. We offer Family to Family, a 12-week course for families that have an adult member with a mental illness. Another popular program is In Our Own Voice, where individuals who are living with mental illness discuss their challenges and their progress in overcoming those challenges. Another course we offer is Basics, a 6-week course for families with a child or an adolescent who has experienced mental illness. We also have a monthly support group for families on the third Thursday of every month. Please call NAMI Hunterdon at 908-284-0500 for more information about any of our programs or to join. NAMI Hunterdon, the voice for mental health in Hunterdon County.
One of the biggest decisions in your lifetime is buying or selling a house. Choosing a realtor with strong client communication, technology, and marketing skills will dramatically improve your chance of success. That's why Hunterdon and Somerset's residents rely on Joe Peters. Joe believes his clients deserve a smooth and seamless experience, not a roller coaster ride. As a Coldwell Banker sales associate with 20 years of experience, he's helped hundreds of people to achieve their goals and dreams, no matter where they were in the buying or selling process. Joe accomplishes this by approaching every transaction from a business perspective. Initially, he tries to fully understand your goals and dreams and make them his own. Then he takes the mass amount of data that's available and distills it down to a few understandable action points. And finally, he controls the entire process through technology and marketing. The end result to you is a smooth, rewarding customer experience. Let Joe show you how to take his professional expertise and put it to work for you. To contact Joe, go to jpeters.com or call 908-238-0118. One of the biggest decisions in your lifetime is buying or selling a house. Choosing a realtor with strong client communication, technology, and marketing skills will dramatically improve your chance of success. That's why Hunterdon and Somerset's residents rely on Joe Peters. Joe believes his clients deserve a smooth and seamless experience, not a roller coaster ride. As a Coldwell Banker sales associate with 20 years of experience, he's helped hundreds of people to achieve their goals and dreams, no matter where they were in the buying or selling process. Joe accomplishes this by approaching every transaction from a business perspective. Initially, he tries to fully understand your goals and dreams and make them his own. Then he takes the mass amount of data that's available and distills it down to a few understandable action points. And finally, he controls the entire process through technology and marketing. The end result to you is a smooth, rewarding customer experience. Let Joe show you how to take his professional expertise and put it to work for you. To contact Joe, go to jpeters.com or call 908-238-0118.
Sabía que de cada 5 personas hay una que lucha con síntomas difíciles de salud mental. NAMI es una organización estatal sin fines de lucro. Somos empleados voluntarios. Somos la voz de la nación sobre las enfermedades mentales. NAMI te ofrece grupos de apoyo, educación e información. Nuestro programa educativo de Familia a Familia está dirigido por miembros de NAMI para familiares y amigos de personas que luchan con dificultad de salud mental. Llámanos al 888-803-3413. Recuerda, no estás solo. NAMI está contigo y no hay salud sin salud mental.
Are you looking to get your message in front of a qualified audience through all the noise out there today? Consider taking an advertisement out on Hunterdon Chamber Radio, WHCR, DB, the voice of business. Contact the Chamber today at 908-782-7115 or give us an email at info@hunterdon-chamber.org.
¿Sabía que de cada 5 personas hay una que lucha con síntomas difíciles de salud mental? NAMI es una organización estatal sin fines de lucro. Somos empleados voluntarios. Somos la voz de la nación sobre las enfermedades mentales. NAMI te ofrece grupos de apoyo, educación e información. Nuestro programa educativo de Familia a Familia está dirigido por miembros de NAMI para familiares y amigos de personas que luchan con dificultad de salud mental. Llámanos al 888-803-3413. Recuerda, no estás solo.
USA Radio News with Tim Berg.
As the impeachment inquiry against President Trump continues, Republican Congressman from Texas John Ratcliffe says wording that's being used by Democrats, including House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, has changed.
Washington Times asked Americans what would be the most damning accusation, and it didn't come back quid pro quo, it didn't come back extortion, it came back bribery. So this case is all about bribery. If Democrats accuse the president of a high crime or impeachable offense, he at least ought to know which one it is. And when Speaker Pelosi says this is all about bribery, she's promised us evidence of bribery that would be compelling and overwhelming, and instead, it's invisible.
The two correction officers on duty when convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein committed suicide are facing charges for falsifying prison records. And you're listening to USA Radio News.
Filling an opening at your company means more than just finding an employee. You're looking for a fit, a match. Robert Half understands that. We know you need someone who can do the work, someone who complements your culture. And, of course, you need that someone fast. When it all comes together, it makes for a perfect fit. Satisfaction guaranteed. Robert Half, the matching experts in accounting, finance, IT, legal, marketing, and administrative staffing. Visit roberthalf.com for more information.
At the American Veterinary Medical Association annual convention in Washington, D.C., I spoke with Dr. John Howe, AVMA president, about One Health.
One Health is really a collaboration between physicians and veterinarians or public health officials. For example, in Minnesota, our state public health veterinarian deals with zoonotic diseases, rabies, for example. Animals are sentinels for humans, and humans are sentinels for some infections in animals.
There's more valuable information at avma.org.
President Trump says if there's no deal with China, he'll raise tariffs even higher.
Look, China's going to have to make a deal that I like. If they don't, that's it, okay? I'm very happy with China right now. They're paying us billions and billions. We'll be over $100 billion in the not-too-distant future.
The president's comments coming before a cabinet meeting at the White House. The president also says he's very happy with where things stand regarding trade talks with China. As the holiday travel season kicks off, new data is out regarding folks wearing their seatbelts. With the details, here's USA Radio Network's Chris Barnes.
Just released data from the Governor's Highway Safety Association shows that last year, 803 unrestrained rear seat vehicle passengers ages 8 and up were killed in crashes on U.S. highways. The association says it shows more than half of those lives might have been saved if the passengers had been properly buckled up.
And you're listening to USA Radio News.
Hi, I'm Wayne Allyn Root, the conservative warrior. My show War Now airs every day right here on USA Radio from 6 to 9 p.m. Eastern.
Hey, Chris, can you hear us? Chris? Chris, are you still there? Hello, Chris. Chris?
Chris, are you there?
I am here.
Okay, we picked you up. Sorry, we were working through some technical difficulties.
See if he's still there.
He is, yep.
Chris, you can hear us?
I can hear you, yeah.
Hey, good, so we're on the air. So, great, so let's introduce ourselves. I'm Joe Peters, I'm the radio show host, and we've got a little different theme. I usually do a real estate in the 55-plus. Today, I've got two people with me. I've got Eric Cole, who's sitting here with me. Hello, Eric.
Hi, how are you, Joe?
And Eric, why don't you tell us a little about your background?
So I'm a 23-year veteran from the Army, a retired lieutenant colonel, and began going into business consulting, and that's where actually Dr. Kalenda and Strategic Leaders Academy came into the picture. So I am a franchisee of that and started Cobra Strategic Leader Consulting, LLC. And so Chris and I work together, as well as three other franchisees. And so here we are today, wanted to talk a little bit with you about the business and equally our most recent experience in Normandy and as well anything else you might have in the discussion.
Great. And Chris, tell us a little about your background.
Thanks, Joe. I really appreciate you having me on the show, and especially being on the show with Eric. I've served in the Army for 24 and a half years, four combat tours in Afghanistan, started my business Strategic Leaders Academy, and for my personal consulting business in 2014, I've helped my clients grow by over $25 million. They've had a 30-to-1 return on investment.
Wow.
And from that, I thought, well, you know, there are a lot of people like me out there who could really be of high value to businesses that want to grow and who want to grow sustainably. And so that's when I created the franchise. And I'm very selective of who I bring on, and as you know, Eric pretty well. And as you can tell from Eric, you know, we have some really top quality people that are just really good at coaching, teaching, very empathetic, and know how to cross that bridge between what works in the military, what works in the business. Not confusing the two, but understanding where things rhyme and how to apply things in ways that make sense to business and nonprofit leaders.
Wow, that's quite a bit of information. I understand that everybody within your organization is a West Point graduate.
Well, we have one Naval Academy graduate,
okay,
and we have one graduate from the University of Denver. So everybody in the organization is a former senior military leader, and all of whom have served distinguished 20-plus year careers have commanded at very senior levels and have worked strategy at very senior levels. So they've got to meet the basic entry requirements in order to be considered, and then we go through a very extensive vetting process to make sure that it's everybody's a good fit. And so that's why we're so highly selective. It's because we want to make sure everybody is just the right fit and can really help businesses.
Well, after meeting Eric, I think you're doing a really great job of getting highly selective people, because the first time we sat down and talked, it was just amazing. So as an exercise, you took the whole company out to Normandy recently?
We did. So I planned to go as a group of franchisees and as a way just to spend time together to use an experience, to walk through how one can use an experience like this and translate it, not just sort of nerd out on what happened on the battlefield, although that, of course, is very important.
Right.
But to use this as a way to help business leaders think differently about their challenges and opportunities. I mean, we all know that experience is the best teacher of leadership, but experience alone helps you be better at things that you've already done and already experienced. It doesn't prepare you for the unexpected or the new or the more complex, and that's where experiential learning and reading and things like that can be very helpful. So that's why we designed this.
Right.
And then we had a Washington, D.C. think tank full of very senior business and former government leaders who heard about this and said, hey, we'd like to come with you. And so we had them with us, and it was just an absolutely tremendous time.
Beautiful. You know, Marilyn and I she's my better half, went to Normandy 2 years ago, just about this time 2 years ago. We started over in St. Malo. We did a little sightseeing at Mount St. Michel. We took the train over to Bayeux, and then we hired a whole day van. There were like three couples went through the whole show. And before we went, we had done one of the YouTube videos as to the battle and how it was fought and what happened. And I was tremendously blown away by what went into the battle that nobody ever talks about. For example, behind the lines, the night before, they dropped the parachuters in. And they also dropped skiffs in, which were large planes with lots of logistical equipment on, like cooking and mess. And I'm trying to name it a church where the guy's parachute got caught on the top, but it was in the longest day. So it wasn't like they just landed the boats and came up. A, it was planned for a long time. B, before they landed the boats, they dropped these people in the night before to clear a way for him to go up the hill and into the area that they wanted him to go into. And then C, there was some sort of mistakes, like they fed everybody, and everybody got seasick from what I read, because it was a rather rough day. But as the guys were coming up the beach, they had to get over to be under the dunes so the machine guns couldn't shoot down on them. And the movie I watched said that that's where, I'm trying to remember, it was Teddy Roosevelt's son, I think, that was the general in charge and took him up the hill. And then the last logistical point was, once they got up the hill and out, and all of this happened over a couple of days, then the cleanup crew came in and picked up the injured, identified the dead. I mean, it was a massive logistical set of things that most people don't even consider. So I think when you're talking about strategical planning, I'm saying, I never understood all of this happened.
You know, you're exactly right, and so many points in that description. Eric gave a tutorial on strategic planning out there for the group, and I'll let him talk about that. We also, so for instance, at St. Mary's Lees, which is where the paratrooper got caught on the steeple with his parachute, we stand right there at the church and we talk about how leaders make decisions under risk and uncertainty. Because John M. Steele was one who's the private that was dangling from the parachute, was one of two people out of about 10,000 who dropped by parachute, and he is one of two people who got caught in the steeple. So you have about a 1 in 5,000 risk or so of getting caught on that steeple.
Right.
But there's also a great deal of uncertainty about, or there was a great deal of risk to the force, certainly, in this drop. In fact, the Allied air commander for that operation, a British air marshal, had recommended to Eisenhower that they call off the airborne landings because the risk to the force is too high.
Right.
But Eisenhower was looking at the uncertainty. He didn't know how the Germans would react to the amphibious landings, the landings coming from the sea.
Right.
And he knew that he needed a hedge against that uncertainty. And the airborne drops were that hedge to protect the flanks of the beaches. So despite the risk to the force, Eisenhower said, we're going to do it anyway because I've got to have this hedge against uncertainty. And of course, Eisenhower was proven right. Unfortunately, the landings did not have as many casualties. The airborne landings didn't have as many casualties as were forecasted. But the Germans tried very to counterattack the Utah Beach in particular,
right,
from some of their positions in the west. And those airborne landings were what prevented those counterattacks from being successful. And so it just becomes, so you're standing in these historically powerful places, and then you talk about how risk and uncertainty played themselves out there, and then we'll open it up to discussion with the business leaders. Well, how do you deal with risk and uncertainty? How do you make decisions under these sort of conditions? And that's when you get the very rich discussion that help people be better business leaders.
Wow. I know one of the other things that we had read up about the part that was way up on the hill where they had actually pulled the guns because the Germans were, I'm trying to remember who was saying, they're not going to attack here, let's move the guns. So they pulled the guns out and put telephone poles in their place so it looked like there was guns up there. And it was just...
Right.
Strategic move and counter-strategic move going on all the way through this. And the Germans, I don't want to give them any credit because of what happened, but they were pretty good strategic people. We had also been elsewhere. We had gone to Hitler's Eagle's Nest. I couldn't believe what they built underground up there. They were, and it may have been just mass labor, but they did some really thought-provoking things in a war. But let's stay on point with Normandy. Another thing we did was we went and visited the cemeteries. And we went to the German cemetery, which I didn't really want to go see. And the guy said, no, what I want to show you is there's not a person in here that's much over 16 years old. These are all young kids just thrown into the war and probably shot the first day in the war. And then when we got to the American cemetery, which is beautiful, I mean, it's breathtaking, overlooks the water at the edge, the average age was 22 years old, and the average tenure was almost 2 years before these guys were sent over. So it's desperation on the German side, throwing the youngsters into the war, and precisiveness on the Allies side of having two-year veterans going into this conflict.
Yeah, and just to build on that, even those sort of young kids that the Germans were just putting in uniform and rushing to the front over there nearly defeated these landings. And part of the reason why they were successful, I mean, you know, in addition to the sheer courage and bravery and skill of the soldiers who are landing at places like why they were successful over time was this huge deception plan called Operation Fortitude, where the Allies had created this fictitious army under General Patton,
right,
and had put out all of this bogus traffic that Patton was going to lead the main attack at Calais, which is about 90 or 100 miles north of Normandy.
Right.
And so the Allies had seeded this deception plan. And it worked marvelously because the Germans had already convinced themselves that Patton would lead the main attack.
Right.
And so, you know, this is how confirmation bias works. You tend to believe data points that reinforce your pre-existing beliefs and discount those data points that are disconfirming. And so, again, we talked about the role of this deception plan and how it tied down well over 100,000 German defenders in Calais who could have been instrumental in counterattacking the Normandy landing, but they didn't move for 8 weeks. The Germans were fooled for 8 weeks after Normandy. The Germans still believed that Patton was going to lead the main attack and didn't give up that belief until Patton was sighted with these tanks running around the German rear areas. So we have this discussion about that, and we talk about confirmation bias. So how as leaders do we help organizations, do we help our organizations overcome confirmation bias? How do we prevent that from damaging our strategic decision making?
And I would think, because I see it in industry all the time, and that people are so reluctant to change their preconceived notion, whether it's good or bad, that a lot of times if you've really outmaneuvered them, they can't react in time. And those telephone poles was a great example. They pulled those guns out so that they could use them elsewhere. But at the same time, these guys lost their life scaling that hill to get up there. And your point that they didn't move the troops for 6 or 8 weeks from Calais. And I've taken a cab from Calais to Bayeux. Bayeux is right above Utah, below Utah. It's a $20 cab ride, so it's not that far. So... Well, no, Calais fervor. I'm thinking of Cannes. Cannes is over right there. So they were very slow to react because of what? And let's talk about the war, and then let's talk about industry. They were very slow to react because I think there was fear of management or power, or Hitler had this iron fist, and nobody wanted to tell him he was wrong. But that happens in life, too, where people are kowtowing to the person in charge and are not ready, willing, or even capable of convincing them elsewise. Because what I read was there was at least 50 assassination attempts on Hitler, none of them successful. The closest one was the one in the conference room. It wasn't like he was revered, it was like he was feared. And we see that in industry as well. And I've seen it where, you know, the boss would say, do this, and people would do it. And then when it goes wrong, he says, well, you should have convinced me that wasn't the right decision. It's like, that's no way to manage people. So I would think what you witnessed there, whatever parts of the beach did you do? I think, you know, the thing that bothered me the most of the whole trip is that when we finally got to the beach just below the American cemetery, it was like the Riviera. Everybody's out there with umbrellas swimming. It's like all of this happened here, and it's just absolutely amazing to me that it's not a preserved beach for its what happened here kind of thing. Another thing we did was we went from there. And I want to back up because I don't think we're enough here. But we went there, we went to Brussels because it was in a way, and we had not seen Brussels. And we flew over to Berlin, and we thought Berlin would be steeped in history. And we were so totally disappointed in Berlin. We actually hired private guides to walk us through the last days of the war in Berlin, which is very interesting. But the general public don't want to talk about what happened in Berlin because it hurts too much. And it took us 3 days to get the feel of, I mean, we actually took an Uber over to where the Luftwaffe Air Fort was, and there were no memorials to World War II. Finally, on the way out, we're sitting at the airport, and I went to the restroom in Quebec, and the woman sat down and was talking to Marilyn, and because there were no seats in the restaurant area, and we told her what our experience was, and she said, well, she tied it all together. I wish I talked to her before we went. She says, you have to realize what happened. She says, there was nobody who didn't know what was going on. She said, you couldn't draw a line and say these people knew and these people didn't. Everybody knew. And if they fought what was going on, they too would be killed. So they looked the other way. And then they went through all the people. I mean, right down to the end of Berlin, they had kids of 13 years old in a bunker shooting machine guns. They went through all the men they had. And her point to us was it hurts so much. We can't talk about it. And here it is, what, 70 years later, three generations, easy. And they're saying that was great-grandpa's war, great-grandma's war. We are moved on. We've rebuilt our lives. We've rebuilt the city. And, yes, you could take historical tours. But that's what you're witnessing is people just don't want to talk about it. But let's move back to Normandy. I felt that it was something everybody should go through just to understand the logistics of how big this operation was, especially when it got up to the American cemetery and in the mausoleum sort of section, not that it was a mausoleum, but it's a covered, they had all the strategic moves that were going on at once. And there must have been 16 or 18 of them, some major ones, some minor ones, some flanking ones, some coming in for the rear ones. It was amazing how complex this battle was.
Yeah, well, and Chris, you know, to talk a little bit of the strategy up front and what went into that, if you think about where they came from in context, Joe, out of the World War, they thought that was the biggest war to ever be fought and there would not be another. And here we go as the United States entering into that interwar period up to World War II. They had literally emaciated the entire military force down to close to 150,000 people.
Wow.
Before. This is 1939 we're talking, and really it's at its lowest.
Right.
And then the strategy it took, for one, the United States to see where we're going and to get beyond what was this Lend-Lease Act that was going on, merely us participating in the war without participating in it.
Right.
To build the force we built that literally the first waves of Normandy had 160,000 people in it. So it completely exceeded what was initially, you know, only a few years before our entire military force. You're right. I mean, what went into it was beyond words, what had to be planned. And so, you know, Chris was mentioning, and I had shared a little bit of that. There was a major in the United States Army. His name was Albert Wiedemeyer. And he basically was charged by George C. Marshall to understand strategically what was going on in the war and what it would take for us to build the forces necessary to enter this war, and not just enter it, but come out victorious, right? And his estimate was absolutely what led the way to exactly what you saw at Normandy, which was, you know, the Operation Overlord and the campaigns that went into that. To include the, you know, the paratroopers that were landed in there to ultimately establish the preconditions for the beach assault to really be successful.
Right.
And you know, like exactly like Chris pointed out, that military deception plan that went into it up front was absolutely instrumental in making sure that the German forces did not. And it was even against, and Chris, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but Rommel's point to Hitler was to focus on Normandy and the beaches thereof in the main effort.
Right.
And Hitler in his own...
infinite wisdom.
Yeah, infinite wisdom or paranoia said no. That, you know, and the indications and warnings were enough for him to believe the false press.
Right. So if you look at it like a football line, and Normandy really was a football line, so if you're headed south, the left side of the line was where they were prepared for us to come in.
Yep.
Yet we came through the center and the right side of the line, and they weren't prepared. But as Chris said, it took them 8 weeks to react.
Absolutely.
You know, when they could have probably reacted in 72 hours and moved a lot of that artillery over because they thought this was the fake approach, and there would be more where they thought it was going to come from.
Yep, and that was with the assistant coaches and the coordinators literally telling them, telling the head coach, no, it's coming. It really is. So, yeah, absolutely. And Chris, go ahead, sorry.
Well, and of course, Hitler in that case had surrounded himself with a bunch of yes people, as Joe pointed out. And so... they're just simply feeding into the confirmation bias that's going on, which, of course, is impeding the German decision-making. One other point that Joe brought up was where they had moved the guns away. So I think what you're referring to is Point of Hoc, which is where the Rangers scaled the cliff, only to find these empty gun emplacements that had been camouflaged because the place was just getting hit so hard. But one of the interesting things that we discussed there on the ground at Point of Hoc, after we get done talking to the Rangers about the Rangers, is we'll go to one of those massive gun emplacements or bunkers where the guns would have been. And we'll talk about organizational silos, because these big bunkers look like silos, and they're as impenetrable as organizational silos. And the Germans, of course, had a huge problem with this, because they essentially had two armies. They had the Army, the SS, the Navy, the Air Force. None of them would talk to one another, because Hitler pitted everybody against one another. The same way within the Army Command. In order to get some tank reserves released, there were different decision loops that each one had to go through. Ultimately, all wound their way through different routes back to, you know, back to Hitler. And all of this is orchestrated not to be more efficient at fighting the battle and winning the war, but it was all orchestrated to prevent a coup, which was his number one concern. And so when you look at these sort of leaders, and, you know, the incentives oftentimes are far different than what we suspect. And this is as true for political leaders oftentimes as it is for business leaders. You may have a lot of different concerns and incentives, and they might be different than what people think they are. So understanding those helps to then understand the behavior.
And it's really hard, because they're buried so deep and sometimes not even expressed or in people's minds, and the people below them don't even know what they're thinking, and they're following the orders to their best ability, but that isn't really the game plan. And then when it's impossible, if you don't share an entire view of the picture, to react properly and say, if we do this, that's going to happen. And that's what happened here. We did this, we moved everybody over to the left side of the line, and they attacked at the center and right, and we didn't believe it as Germans. I'm putting myself in their place. And we didn't believe it because they were protecting themselves, things like one of the coups. As I said, there were 50 times they tried to assassinate him. I also, I'm trying to remember who it was, pulled the guns out. It was one of the high command people. He didn't pull them far. He pulled them like 8 miles back into the woods, back about where the church was. They weren't really taken over to the left side of the line yet. They could have been put back in place, but not in a day's time. So you had different people on different missions not working together, and as a result, the whole project failed from the German side, where the project from the Allied side, because it wasn't just Americans, was, I don't know what the right word is, but it was hampered by some really poor decisions, like feeding the troops before they got onto a rocky road on the way over on the water that day. The fact that they were letting come off the front of the boat, and the guys were getting machine guns as soon as they opened it up, so they were diving off the sides, and that was 12 foot of water, and they were drowning. The other thing I felt was an amazing, and it was in this YouTube thing I saw, they calculated that a machine gun bullet can only travel 16 inches underwater. So the guys jumping off the side of the boat weren't getting machine gunned. They were drowning.
And Joe, like, you know, just you talking that piece makes me think back, and Chris can certainly expound upon this, but I think what made it really different from our side on the Allied side was the method about which we command our force.
Right.
And it really is a centralized planning but decentralized control method that, you know, guys like Ray Lambert, and Chris can tell the story, but guys like Ray Lambert are what made Normandy a success, because they, what's in them is what drove them to victory that day and the days beyond, and that they would fight for their their buddy to the left and the right. That's what was so different about what we put in as allies to that,
Chris,
you know, that front campaign.
Tell us a little about Ray Lambert.
So Ray Lambert was a grew up in Depression era Alabama. Eventually enlisted in the Army in 1940 as a medic, and found himself in the 1st Infantry Division. And Ray was in every amphibious landing in the European theater. So he landed in the first wave at North Africa.
Wow.
He landed in the first wave in Sicily. And he landed in the first wave on D-Day. So he's with the 16th Infantry on Easy Red, Omaha Beach. Mm-hmm. And, I first met Ray during the 60th anniversary of D-Day. And 9 years later, we'd gone back together at Normandy for the 69th anniversary. And I was able to spend a lot of time with Ray. And I asked him, I said, Ray, do you know where you landed? And he's like, I think I've got a pretty good idea of where it was. And so we and a French friend of ours went down to the beach, and Ray points to this chunk of concrete that's sitting on Omaha Beach, he said, right there. And we walked over there, and Ray begins to describe, the first time he's been back to that specific point, 69 years, since D-Day, and he begins to describe what he remembers from that day.
Wow.
Where he had gotten off the first wave of the 31 people in his Higgins boat, only 7 survived.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. So 24 people out of 31 in his Higgins boat were killed. Ray lands in about chest deep of water, machine guns going all around him, and he wades ashore. And he's looking for a place where he can bring casualties to treat them under cover so they're not getting shot at by German fire. And he sees this big chunk of concrete. So he places one of his medics at that concrete block and says, you stay here, treat the casualties. I'm going to go back and get them. So Ray makes several trips back in waves. Under fire the entire time, complete disregard for his own personal safety. And at one point he gets shot in the elbow. Ray says, that just, you know, that one just made me mad. Another trip back, a German shell explodes and a big chunk of, it takes a big chunk of flesh out of his leg.
Wow.
So Ray could have just sat there and called for a medic. But instead, Ray applies a tourniquet to himself, gives himself a shot of morphine, and continues bringing casualties up to that casualty collection point.
Well, and it's not over, right, Chris?
Yeah, here comes the shorter. he then sees a soldier drowning in the wave, so he beats feet back into the wave, grabs his shoulder, grabs the soldier, begins to move him, forward, and just then another Higgins boat comes up behind him, drops the ramp right on Ray's back, essentially breaking Ray's back. So he's just operating on pure adrenaline at this point.
Yeah.
Eventually is able to get out from under the ramp, takes the soldier up to the rock, and he says, yeah, you're good now, you need to go forward. And at that point, Ray collapses from pain, a broken back, loss of blood, and he wakes up in a hospital ship. And he knew that his brother was on Omaha Beach about 150 yards or so away from Ray. And when Ray is getting unloaded from the, you know, off the hospital ship, somebody says, oh, Lambert, you know, there's another Lambert here. And they brought the next stretcher out, and it turns out it was Ray's brother. His brother Bill, who survived, badly wounded. He survived, and Ray will be 99 years old, 99 years young next week.
That's amazing.
And and so last October of 2018, our French friend and I worked with the French government to put a plaque up on that rock on Omaha Beach.
Okay.
As a tribute to Ray and his medics that served there from the 2nd Battalion, 16th Infantry Regiment. And so now, you know, hundreds of thousands of people walk by that rock every year, and now they know what happened there. And so he's an extraordinary story, he's the quintessential greatest generation person, and it's just an honor to know him and be his friend.
I got to admit, these stories are mind-boggling. I think if we take the lesson away, and we have about 5 minutes to go, so I want everybody to have a chance to say what's on their mind, but I think if we take the lesson away, better strategic planning is going to render better results. And it sounds like the Allies had much better strategic planning, and better reaction to strategic planning would render better anti-results. So the fact that the Germans didn't move their troops for almost 8 weeks is just mind-boggling. But when that's happening in management structure out of fear or poor management, it happens every day. I've seen it. I've worked in corporate America. I realize that people are afraid of losing their job. And as a result, they do what they're told. And as a result, they don't really have their heart in it. And as a result, the job doesn't get done very well. It's a very close correlation to what happened here.
Mm-hmm. And I know if I'm reading Chris's mind right, which I think I'm, the Jedi thing's working, what he would say, I think, is the idea of strategic and planning in the same concept is somewhat of a dichotomy. So that idea of strategy really is the competitive interaction, right? So it's having the context to be a sumo wrestler and understand how to shift and change when necessary, while the plans are those things that ultimately get the action to start occurring and move it forward. So if you don't have a plan that's tied to the strategy directly and that's easily changeable and adjustable, you're right. It's completely ineffective. And that goes whether that's, you know, the entire D-Day experience or whether that's businesses today.
And I got to admit, from the bottom up, you don't sometimes see the strategic plan. You're just part of it. But from the top down, you should have your commanders under you in direct management of parts of that strategic plan, or the plan's not going to work. So you've got people looking at the top of your heads, and you've got people looking at your face. It's a different strategy altogether. The people looking at your face are shooting at you, but the people looking at the top of your heads are saying go this way versus go that way, and bringing up reinforcements or changing and saying drop more guys behind the line. Chris, why don't you take the last 2 minutes and sum us up here?
Thanks, Joe. And Eric hit the nail on the head. I mean, great organization. Get the big things right. Leadership, culture, and strategy. And that's how they grow sustainably. That's how they maintain competitive advantages. And some of the, whether it's Normandy or Gettysburg, there's a lot of lessons from those experiences that can really help people think through, business leaders, think through their challenges. Or how do I get the big things right? Or how do I get them righter than I've got now in order to help my business grow sustainably and maintain competitive advantages? And so that's kind of people like Eric and I can bring. We're not going to tell you how to what app to make or how to run your business for you. We're going to help you get the big things right. So you were empowered to grow sustainably.
Beautiful. So if one of our listeners wanted to talk to you further, Chris, how would they reach you? Chris, you still there?
Chris, did we lose you?
I couldn't hear that question.
Okay, so the question was, if somebody that's listening in would like to talk to you further about business, how would they reach you?
So the best way is through our website, which is strategicleadersacademy.com.
Okay.
And there's a way to contact, you can contact us directly through there, or you can go to my email address, chris@strategicleadersacademy.com. Just send me an email, and I'm pretty responsive.
Beautiful.
And so is Eric.
Eric, the same way?
Yep, same way. We each have our own portion there on Strategic Leaders Academy. And equally, it's eric.kober@strategicleadersacademy.com.
Beautiful. Well, guys, thanks for the last 45 minutes. We had a little bit of a late start, but I think we got the gist across.
Yeah, it's been rich.
Listeners, thank you for tuning in. If you like this, we'll repeat it and go further and talk about other strategical things. I think one of the conversations I'd like to have would be, why did Hitler attack Moscow when he saw Napoleon made the same stupid mistake 100 years ago? It's like,
for sure.
Some people don't learn from history.
Yeah.
But,
well, and we didn't even scratch the surface on Afghanistan, which is the original reason I had
so
brought Chris in. But
sometime
absolutely.
In January, February, let's get back and talk about more current strategic and how it is. Guys, thanks a lot for joining me today. I appreciate it very much. And we will get back to you. I'll send you the audio and visual of today's event. And then we'll reschedule something for after the first of the year.
Thanks, Joe.
Thanks for having us, Joe. It's a real honor to be out here with you.
My pleasure. Thank you.
One of the biggest decisions in your lifetime is buying or selling a house. Choosing a realtor with strong client communication, technology, and marketing skills will dramatically improve your chance of success. That's why Hunterdon and Somerset's residents rely on Joe Peters. Joe believes his clients deserve a smooth and seamless experience, not a roller coaster ride. As a Coldwell Banker sales associate with 20 years of experience, he's helped hundreds of people to achieve their goals and dreams, no matter where they were in the buying or selling process. Joe accomplishes this by approaching every transaction from a business perspective. Initially, he tries to fully understand your goals and dreams and make them his own. Then he takes the mass amount of data that's available and distills it down to a few understandable action points. And finally, he controls the entire process through technology and marketing. The end result to you is a smooth, rewarding customer experience. Let Joe show you how to take his professional expertise and put it to work for you. To contact Joe, go to jpeters.com or call 908-238-0118.
USA Radio News with Tim Berg.
The House passed a short-term spending bill to avoid a partial government shutdown this week and extend government funding through December 20th. The Senate is expected to easily pass a measure in the coming days, and the White House has signaled that President Trump will sign it. Two more witnesses are before the House Intelligence Committee during the third day of the impeachment hearings. Special U.S.-Ukraine envoy Kurt Volker and former National Security Council official Tim Morrison are in the spotlight. California Republican Devin Nunes calls the impeachment hearings a farce.
Welcome back to Act Two of today's circus, ladies and gentlemen. We are here to continue what the Democrats tell us is a serious, somber, and even prayerful process of attempting to overthrow a duly elected president.
Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell is calling on the House to move forward with approving the U.S.-Mexico-Canada agreement. And you're listening to USA Radio News.
Liberty Mutual Insurance Company presents
Lemu. And Doug.
Lemu, when we're not telling people that Liberty Mutual customizes your car insurance so you only pay for what you need, I've actually been moonlighting as a DJ.
What?
Check it! Here's the good part!
Liberty.
Only pay for what you need at libertymutual.com.
Now you can fly anywhere in the world and pay discount prices on your airline tickets. Book a flight today to London, Paris, Madrid, or anywhere else you want to go. And pay a lot less guaranteed. Call the International Travel Department right now at Low Cost Airlines.
800-215-5141. 800-215-5141. That's 800-215-5141.
The long-awaited Inspector General's report examining Russia collusion and the alleged FISA abuse that led to it will be released in December. USA Radio Network's Robin Walensky reports.
The Inspector General's report to be released before the end of this year. South Carolina Senator Republican Lindsey Graham says Michael Horowitz will testify December 11th before the Senate Judiciary Committee. The detailed report should shed light on the Russia collusion investigation and the alleged FISA abuse that led to it.
The Senate is urging President Trump and the administration to support the protesters of Hong Kong. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell.
I would encourage this president, who has seen Chinese behavior for what it is, with a clarity that others have lacked, not to shy away from speaking out on Hong Kong himself. The world should hear from him directly that the United States stands with these brave men and women.
The Kentucky Republican on the Senate floor today. And you're listening to USA Radio News.